May it please the Court. Martin Pruse appears on behalf of Jeremiah Berg. The bottom line with regard to the joinder and the severance issue is that it was never addressed at the trial court level until after Mr. Berg's conviction. And because the offenses in counts 1, 2, and 3 of the indictment were so distinct in character from the offenses in counts 4, 5, and 6, they should never have been joined.
But you would agree, would you? I mean, here's how I see this argument. There certainly is a similarity between the 1, 2, 3 group and the 4, 5, 6 group. But there are a couple of points to make. One of them is that since this was not raised in a timely manner so that the district court could have done something about it, I think at best you're dealing with plain error. Secondly, this is a two-edged sword because juries are going to be able to keep straight in their mind, you know, the evidence that's pertinent to the marijuana and gun set of counts, and on the other hand, the evidence pertinent to the cocaine counts. It's nice and separate, so the risk of spillover in that sense isn't that big. So you're left with just saying, well, not unlike what we were talking about with 404B, you know, maybe the jury's just going to think this guy's a bad guy, and he sometimes deals with marijuana and sometimes guns and sometimes cocaine, so we're going to have that kind of vague prejudicial spillover. But on plain error review, there is some link. It's not the strongest I've ever seen, but when it's plain error, I'm not sure how you can raise it this late in the day.
And, Judge, we're also raising ineffective assistance of counsel for failure to move to join in a timely way. And the prejudice that...
So are you abandoning just the straightforward argument that there's a Rule 8 or a Rule 14 violation?
No, we're arguing that there were.
You're sticking with that?
Yes.
Okay.
But the prejudice was really, I think, significant in this case. When the court considers that the natural inference that where these two groups of completely distinct offenses are tried together to the
same
jury.
Why is there such prejudice? I mean, it seemed like the evidence was pretty strong on both of them. They find in Canada, you know, one of these guns that he has. Certainly the cocaine evidence is quite strong. They've got the three buys. They've got him handing off to Pinetza.
I don't think that the evidence was that strong. First, Mr. Berg was prejudiced because he had to defend both of these really distinct cases to the same jury. And that precluded him from pursuing different defenses.
What would he have done? I mean, you make that argument in your brief, and it's not clear to me what advantage he would have taken.
Well, one of the main ways is that because these were not severed or because these counts were joined, the confessions of Mr. Berg regarding both counts 1, 2, and 3 and 4, 5, and 6 were all provided to the jury during the government's case. And so Mr. Berg, when he ultimately had to, if he had been able to address to have two trials, he might have approached them completely differently. He might not have testified in, for example, the first trial, one would have been held first.
Why would that have made any sense, though? I mean, there are these confessions, and the government certainly could have used them in both trials. He had this theory that they were false confessions, essentially. And his only way of really getting that theory before the jury, either in the joint trial that he had or in two trials, would have been to take the stand. Otherwise, the jury has his confession.
Well, that's not necessarily true. But because he was faced with all of these, with both of these confessions in the same jury, that influenced his decision whether or not he was even going to testify. If he had had a separate trial on, for example, the marijuana case, then he may have decided not to testify and
relied on... Even though his confession covered that material.
It did, but there, I think that there are different ways of attacking confessions other than having the defendant testify. For example, having counsel point out or cross-examine the investigator regarding what leading questions he was asking, or showing that the evidence which is presented to the jury other than the confessions is inconsistent with the alleged confession.
But it wasn't here, was it?
Well, in the case of the cocaine case, the three cocaine distribution charges, there was never any video, for example, of Mr. Berg conducting a hand-to-hand transaction. Also, this also leads into the other issue that we're bringing, which is regard to the failure of the court to ask to query Mr. Painezza, who was the third person in the cocaine transactions, regarding whether or not he actually wanted to assert the Fifth Amendment. There was nothing in the record to indicate that Mr. Painezza actually did want to assert the Fifth Amendment.
Well, there was the representation from his counsel, and your argument on this is a little strange because Mr. Berg's trial counsel said he didn't want to call Mr. Painezza after all because that would have opened the door to impeachment that would have been harmful to your client.
Well, that
and
was...
And so it's certainly not incumbent upon the court in that situation to step in and say, hey, wait a second, you want to reconsider that? Let's get the guy in here and find out if he really does want to invoke the Fifth.
Counsel's decision not to call Mr. Painezza was largely predicated on an attorney, Mr. Singh, who never appeared on the record in this case, who said only that he advised his client to assert the Fifth Amendment.
Now,
we don't know.
Not a correct characterization of the rationale, at least so far as it was put on the record. Counsel said that it was a double-edged sword, essentially, because if Mr. Painezza had been called to testify about what he put in his affidavit recanting everything he said before about Mr. Berg, he would have been impeached with his prior statements, and so that would have been damaging to your client's case. In other words, it would have helped the prosecution, and so there was no upside to pursuing him as a witness.
And on top of that, I mean, as Judge Sykes already pointed out, reading this record, it looks to me like it was actually Mr. Berg's lawyer who decided, let's just forget about Painezza. Here's this that the lawyer has advised Painezza, and the lawyer says, I'm not going to call him. And I don't see where the judge needs to, I don't either see where the judge needs to step in. Now, if the judge herself had made, or himself had made the decision, I'm going to overrule your motion to call Painezza, blah, 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 you know, maybe we'd have a different situation, but we don't.
I think that counsel's decision was predicated. They had filed they had arranged to have him procured for court.
Right.
Mr. Berg wanted him procured and didn't, but at the moment that it was put on the record, Mr. Berg was never queried by the court as to whether what his desires were with regard to that witness.
But why can't, that's not usually done with a client, though. You have to be asked about your decision to testify yourself, but your lawyer's decision about other witnesses to call are not something that the court constantly checks back with the client about.
I see that I'm...
Yeah, you're running into your rebuttal time if you want to save a bit.
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Jonathan Koenig, and I appear on behalf of the United States this morning. As the questioning that went before established, there are two different ways of looking at the severance issue. One is as a sort of a standalone ineffective assistance argument. The other is as a standalone severance argument, which would, in fact, be subject to plain error review. But no matter how the issue is framed, the defendant fails to show reversible error in the government's opinion because he had a fair trial and because the evidence against him as to both sets of crimes was overwhelming. And I would refer you to pages 22 and 23 of our brief for a summary of what the evidence was. I would also direct you to Exhibits 10 and 11, which are the video statements that were given by Mr. Berg. There's been some resistance to videotaping statements in the law enforcement community, but there are times when a videotaped confession really gives a clear sense of atmospherics and how the person being interviewed is feeling and behaving. And I think once you look at those exhibits, it would be fairly easy for you to understand why the jury did not believe Mr. Berg when he claimed to be so nervous that he wanted to make things up in order to present himself as a good cooperator.
So just to nail down the point, I mean, I gather the thing that causes this all to turn into one prosecution unit is the confession, essentially, that he winds up talking about everything in the confession. Now, had it been indicted as two separate cases, you would have used the confession in each case, I assume.
Yes.
Whether or not he testified.
Well, certainly if he testified, it would come in as to discredit his recantation
right.
of the statements.
So what if he had chosen to exercise his Fifth Amendment right?
I think there's a 404B argument as well. I wouldn't rest that argument so much on intent because I know that it leads over into propensity, and I'm aware from the Miller case that we need to be careful about that, but certainly knowledge. I mean, if I assume the defense would have at least been similar had he not testified, and the defense is, you know, he's a casual user. He just happened to show up to buy marijuana when those coke deals were going down. Well, no, not really. He knows the drug trade, and here's the evidence in the two mm-hmm. interviews. Mm-hmm. And I would add also that he...
So in other words, the other half of the confession, if it's severable.
Yes.
Yeah.
Was the ATF investigation that was opened in 2008 on the gun trafficking and gun and marijuana trafficking, was that still open at the time that the Brown County agency got involved?
I believe so. I don't know for certain. I can find out if you like.
Well, I'm just trying to get a handle on how distinct these two courses of conduct and these two investigations were as a matter of fact to determine to what extent the evidence overlapped, because that's relevant to the severance question. Judge Griesbach obviously thought that things overlapped to a sufficient degree, and this is in part based on the confessions, but I think also in part based on the course of conduct that the cases, the two sets of crimes were appropriately joined and that severance would not have been granted had counsel thought to move for it. So that's the import of my question. If it was one investigation was still ongoing when the other one sort of started and picked up and ran in a different direction mm-hmm. and then the confessions tied them all up, you know, then we really don't have a problem here. Is that a fair estimation of what the record shows?
I think I don't want to guess as to things that are outside the record, but I think law enforcement people in a community like Green Bay talk to each other a lot, and probably ATF investigation did remain open, and the two came together in 2010, and you heard in the confession that he gives to Detective Ehrenstein where he said, oh, by the way, I was a big marijuana dealer back in the in the day.
Yeah, he's the one who brings it up, right?
I mean, yes, indeed, Your Honor.
The detective thinks he's just getting a confession in the cocaine case, and then Mr. Berg wanders off in this other direction.
And then clearly there's also some cooperation that occurs. That is in the record. Cooperation that occurs immediately after the late June arrest in 2010.
Or something? What did it?
Yes.
He was involved in a transaction.
It didn't go well, but it was a drug. It was a drug thing. I'm not sure if ATF was in the loop at that point or not. They certainly were, obviously, by July 16th.
But it's his motivation for offering more. Perhaps he says that in his brief. You know, he was hoping to get some benefit from cooperating.
Yes. Yeah. I think the broader point is that Mr. Berg is a drug dealer, and the crimes are the same or have a similar character. And you can find differences. It was a different kind of controlled substance. In one case, he was using guns in place of cash. In the other case, it was cash. Cash was the medium of exchange. But But drug dealing is drug dealing. I did want to point out, because I'm not sure that we emphasized this in our brief, that there was an instruction to the jury to consider the counts separately. And as Your Honors are aware, there's a presumption that jurors follow jury instructions. So I wanted to be sure that that was highlighted for you as to the severance issue. And I really don't have too much to say about Mr. Peinetsa. I think it strains believability that he would ignore his lawyer's advice in this situation. He had kind of opened himself up to perjury already with this affidavit. And so in order to go with the defendant's argument, you really have to think that, A, he would have ignored his lawyer's advice, and, B, it somehow would have been helpful to the defendant. And I can't see my way past either of those. And I don't think you should either, and we would ask you respectfully to affirm the conviction.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
On rebuttal, I'd just like to address Judge Sykes' question with regard to evidentiary overlap. In these two courses of conduct, there was no evidentiary overlap. Mr. Berg was in the counts 1, 2, and 3, marijuana, use of a firearm in furtherance of a drug crime, and felon in possession, all focused on an investigation by the ATF using informants, the Elizondos, and it was between December of 2007 and March of 2008. And then there was an attempt to sell Mr. Berg firearms by an undercover agent of the ATF, which Mr. Berg briefly attended in a Walmart parking lot, looked at the guns, apparently never touched a gun, left. And that was the end of the ATF investigation. Nothing happened for about 2 years. And then what happened is there's an investigator for the Brown County Drug Task Force, Investigator Ehrenstein, who's using a confidential informant, Russell LaRock, to do controlled buys involving Mr. Peinetsa. This is in April and May of 2010, in three very discreet instances.
So just to cut to the chase, then, it's the confessions, really, that overlap.
It's the only overlap, and only did it overlap in terms of getting it in and using it to, as the district court did in its, to basically, if the only time that there was any evidentiary overlap was when Mr. Berg testified. At that point, the government says, okay, well, now he's denied his statements, so we can use both his statements to cross impeach. And so the only overlap is his statements, and those statements probably wouldn't have been admitted in a trial of counts 1, 2, and 3, or 4, 5, and 6, or vice versa. But the basis for admitting those is that he decided to recant his confessions only after the government's case had already been put in completely. And so I just wanted to point that out.
Thank you very much, Counselor.
Thank you.
And he was appointed, Mike. He was appointed.
And you were appointed to this case?
Yes, sir.
You did an excellent job for your client, and the court thanks you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.